The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by Andy the Snowblower Hamilton, unoriginal but very true. You've been blowing a lot of snow with your snowblower, and I have you to thank for snowblowing my driveway. Thank you.
You're welcome, Kyle.
Do you enjoy doing it?
To a certain degree. After doing it for an hour this morning and probably another hour clearing yours later on, doing some sidewalks around here, I might not enjoy it quite as much as I do maybe the first couple times a year, but it's not bad.
It gets me outside a little bit. I've never used a snowblower in my life. It's always been shoveling, so I would like to experience it at some point.
Well, we can make that happen this afternoon.
Well, I'd prefer it not be today because I'd really like seeing you do it. You do such a great job that I'll take the hand shoveling, and I'll leave the snowblower to you because I don't want to break your snowblower. I just wouldn't think that's right.
You think you would?
You never know.
Is that a legitimate fear?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to break other people's property, and certainly with you, I do not want to break your property, but thank you. It is cold in the Midwest. Not exactly cold, but just a lot of snow, and we're dealing with that, but that's part of the gig when you're in this great state of Iowa. We also have tons of great wrestling, not only here, but there's been tons of great wrestling that has gone on throughout the country. We're nearing the end of the dual meet schedule right now, and I don't know if there's been a highlight duel for you that stands out as the best one. I think the best one of the year is going to be Iowa-Oklahoma State, which is going to be in a few days, but other than that, do you have one that sticks out as the best duel of the year so far?
Iowa-Iowa State was pretty entertaining.
Sure.
A lot of drama there. A lot of stuff going on. That was a really good dual meet.
From a sheer domination point of view, Penn State still is a blast to watch because you're going to get some fun things. Bo Nickel gets another pin on the season over a high quality opponent. And we've been shaking our heads about this guy. This guy is really on a different realm. I don't think there's any question that Bo Nickel is the best wrestler in the country this season.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think there's any question?
No, I mean, other than a teammate, I don't know who else it would be. Who would be in the running?
Obviously Jason Nolf has had a fantastic year. I mean, Mark Hall.
Yeah.
It's been pretty impressive. There've been some, Yanni's undefeated still. Anthony Ashnault's had a terrific season, but I think you're talking Hodge Trophy. You're talking Nickel and Nolf in a class of their own right now.
Yeah. And I think
Gable Steveson, let's not leave him out.
Steveson's up there. I just still have a couple pieces of information I want to see with him. I think, he's had some marquee wins so far this year, but hey, when you're Bo Nickel and you're pinning Colin Moore, who's a two-time age level world medalist in what was it, close to a minute? Just really made it look pretty matter of fact. You're on a different realm than everyone else. And it's not necessarily domination always. It's domination over great competition. And he's doing that right now time and time again. And another guys, we've talked about guys we're looking forward to seeing for years to come. Bo Nickel's in that class. Can't wait to see him hopefully on a couple year Olympic cycle. Because Team USA has got to be excited about him. But he's got great guys standing in his way. And Jaden Cox and Bo Nickel, I think, is a matchup that hopefully a lot of people would want to see, Andrew.
Yeah, really intriguing to see which way Bo goes long term. Is he going to become a 97-kilo guy? Can he get that big? Is that where his best spot is long term?
He'll go down. But
do you?
Yeah, I do. I think he'll go down to...
I was surprised just how big he was over in Budapest. We get a chance to spend some time with him over there, and certainly adjusting well to this weight class. But, Kyle, I tweeted this Friday night after the dual meet, right after he'd pinned Colin Moore. I tweeted, Bo Nickel is the most dangerous wrestler the college level has seen since fill in the blank. And there were some pretty interesting responses in there. You know, when you think of dangerous, what do you think of?
I think of someone that can destroy your will at any point in the match. It's not relentless. It's has a skill set that can, I think dangerous necessarily comes with putting you to your back. I think that's what it's all about. Yeah. From a position of immediacy. It's not like you get on top and you turn someone or tilt them. That's not dangerous. It's someone who has a skill set that it can put you on your back in a very, not necessarily matter of fact way, but in a very quick way. And especially I think of it from the standing position that someone's going to throw you or put you to your back, feet to back immediately. That's usually what I think of. And so there's a few guys that fit that category. There's a lot of guys that are great that don't fit it. Tom and Terry Brands are not dangerous. They're relentless and they probably have that tab more than anyone. And you could go down the list of different people. John Smith wasn't dangerous. He was calculated and had that low single. He was innovative, but from a dangerous standpoint, there's a few names that come to mind, but I'll tell you what, Nichols near the top.
Yeah.
I think you're saying he is the top.
Well, this is my 20th year covering college wrestling. I've never seen anybody like him. I've never seen anybody that can just put you in so much danger from top, bottom, neutral, so many different ways. And not just that he's pinning guys in a lot of different manners, but he's pinning elite guys. I've never felt like when an elite guy steps out there at other weights, I've never felt this way that, you know, there's a percentage chance, a decent percentage chance that they might get pinned. I thought there was a decent percent shot the other night that Colin Moore would get pinned. And I don't think I would say that about a guy of Colin Moore's caliber wrestling at any other weight class against the top ranked guy.
So who have people said? I have my list of people in my head. It goes with Randy Lewis, Gene Mills, Wade Chalice. We had a conversation about Ben Askren. I would put him in that category. I think you maybe wouldn't as much.
I certainly think he was dangerous. There were some positions where Ben was really, really dangerous. He was a phenomenal scrambler. I don't know that he pinned elite guys in quite as many ways as Bo has. He racked up a ton of falls. I just don't remember thinking when some of the top 74 pounders were going to go out there against Ben Askren, like, you know, are they going to survive? Is this match going to go 7 minutes? But yeah, Ben could maybe put up 15 points against him and major him. And he put on a heck of a show in the NCAA finals that year against Jake Herbert. And I don't want to sound like I'm discounting how great Ben Askren was at all.
Yeah, I think the question is just danger. Like yeah. Same thing with Tom and Terry. We're not saying they're necessarily dangerous wrestlers. They have other skill sets and maybe the best at what they do, but the dangerous tab. And I think to a certain degree, it doesn't necessarily have to be pinning, although that's the major part. And in my example kind of proves my point wrong, but I think of when Mark Perry was behind at the Nebraska Omaha Open to Moza Faye, you kind of knew he was going to pull it out. Then I think in the last 30 seconds, he pinned him. To me, that's danger. Like this guy can do it anytime. You don't know what he's going to come up with. He's unpredictable. And I would put Mark Perry in that category too.
Yep.
So most dangerous wrestler, if you have your thoughts, check out Andy's Twitter question. It's a great question that we have. And as we talk about international wrestling, you've been following it and you get to actually go to the championships oftentimes. For fans who like the narrative of international wrestling, what would your suggestion be on the best way to become a fan or to follow international wrestling? I know that it can be hard sometimes finding results, but I'd be interested to know myself because I like the product, but sometimes it's hard to know where things are and what things are happening. Some people will send me information and say, check this out. I didn't know it was happening. But if you want to get into international wrestling, what's the best way to be a fan? Do you have ideas?
It's a lot easier now than it used to be because UWW in the last 5 years since wrestling, 5-6 years since wrestling was put on the Olympic chopping block has done such a better job of promoting its global stars, letting people know when events are coming up. They've updated that calendar so much better. It used to be one of my biggest frustrations about 5-6 years ago was watching a tournament and then it was such a wild goose chase trying to figure out what this person was ranked and what their credentials were, but it's the information's out there between Foldeek, which has results back for years and years and years, for lack of a better term. It's probably like the track wrestling of international wrestling, where it's got results and you can look at bios and things of that nature. Wikipedia has become a much better source in terms of just quickly punching in a name like Haji Aliyev, and you can figure out which years he won world championships, medals, performances at world championships. Wikipedia has results from past world championships and Olympic games as well. But the one thing that UWW has done a lot better job at is they update that calendar, what's going on, what's coming up. And then their video team has done a tremendous job of producing high level, engaging video mashups. And so it's become easier. Matches are so much easier to find now. We've talked about this before, that a guy like Satiev, it was 10, 15 years ago, it was really hard to find matches of him. And you might be able to watch him wrestle once every 4 years in the Olympic Games. And now, as I've mentioned on past shows, a guy like Petrushvili, two-time heavyweight world champion now, we had him on our platform in 2017, probably. I would guess we probably streamed 20 of his matches. There were probably 20 of his matches that we streamed live and had archived between World Cup, Continental Championships at the U23 and senior level, and then World Championships at the U23 and senior level as well. So it's a lot easier. Those are the sources that I would go to. And we tried to spotlight last year, leading up to the World Championships. The last couple of years, we've done like countdowns to Paris, countdown to Budapest, 100-day countdown featuring 100 of the top stars internationally. So that stuff is out there now. It's a lot more readily available than it used to be.
So if we went to just say the cross culture of, or a cut of college wrestling duels, so if you go to Penn State, Oklahoma State, Iowa, Iowa State, whatever program you want, how many people do you think would know who Sadulayev is? I think that would be a barometer of where we are and our understanding of it. Because I think as we think about the casual fan and college wrestling, is that are they checked in enough that they would know two or three of those big names internationally? Of course, they know Kyle Snyder, Burroughs, you would think, or Hope at this point, but would they know their rivals? Would they know their competitors? I think Sadulayev is different because of what happened and how things transpired in 2017 and the matchups, but I bet there's a lot of guys that just love their local wrestling product that don't know who Sadulayev is.
Should we ask our audience here?
We could.
Do you know who Sadulayev is? Okay.
All right. You ask someone that doesn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My girlfriend's daughter, Abby, sitting over here as we're recording. She's okay. A wrestling fan.
Yeah.
Boyfriend's a wrestler. Does not know Sadulayev. I think I'm intrigued. I'm fascinated by the question.
I would love to know. And especially if you even went to a different level. Let's say you go to a youth wrestling tournament. How many people would know John Smith over Ken Chertow? I bet more people know who Ken Chertow is than John Smith because of the camps.
Think so.
I do.
I don't know.
I do. I really do. Because of the camps and his branding and what he's done, I think that at a certain level, I'm not saying that it's college or any other level. I'm saying the youth level where he's been able to brand himself, I think that Ken Chertow, I think he was the master of branding. I think he would maybe be a bigger name in certain circles. Not bigger name, but his name recognition would be higher in certain circles.
I've never thought of that, but that's an interesting point.
Yeah,
let's start doing some surveys, Kyle.
We could. What would it be? Just Twitter? Should we do it?
I don't know.
Survey Monkey on this one?
The thing is, the people that follow us on Twitter are the people that
are diehards.
That know who Sadulayev is.
Because I've done this question before. I did this at Junior Nationals. I just did a random poll, and there were some table workers. And I remember asking just Dan Gable. I said, hey, do you know who Dan Gable is? And one girl said, is he a table worker? And it, I mean, but that's the level of disparity you get here. And so, and then you would get some parents who just got into it and they said, you know what? I didn't know until recently, until my sons got into it, but now I'm starting to learn about them. So I think that's the case, is that there's a lot of people that are uneducated about the history of our sport, because it's sometimes it's just not as accessible. Hey, people know who Derek Jeter is, LeBron, all these top names, but it's a little bit harder to find. But with social media and the internet and things out there, I think it's yeah. more readily available.
And the hard part for us as a sport is a lot of these big time events are going on in the middle of the night, and we're, you have to watch, get up at 2-3 in the morning to watch a tournament over in Russia or over in Europe somewhere. And that's difficult. It's one of the impediments we face as a sport in growing it, at least in our country, on an international scale.
And as we talk about growing it, I think we've talked about the youth movement. I think we've spent so much time on that aspect that we forget that there's a coaching movement that has really taken over. We have Tony Robey on the program today. He's the head wrestling coach at Virginia Tech. But as I've thought about what we had last week with Kerry Collott, thinking about Tony Robey, thinking about the coaches we have, not only is it the caliber of young wrestlers coming up, the caliber of coaching is as high yeah. as it's ever been. If you think back even just to the names of the programs that we have that are now relevant because of the name, Chris Bono's at South Dakota State. Now it's Damian Hahn. Every single job seems to have a guy that is a high profile name, some that we've identified with through their career. I think the coaching part of it doesn't get as much love as it should.
I think you're right on. I think you're 100% right on. There are a lot of bright young minds in the sport right now. It's incredible. We get a chance to talk to them. We've done it for the last year since we've gone to the podcast format. I think I'm on how many Division I head coaches we've had on, and how many of them have we finished up the interview and we've been like, wow, that was awesome. And you kind of feel like, man, I would like to wrestle for a guy like that. It's been week after week after week, and that's been really cool. I think one of the things, you know, I was going to sidetrack here for a little bit, but, how about the Campbell fundraiser last week? We had Kerry on in the middle of that fundraiser. We didn't get a chance to talk to him about it, but they raised what, close to $80,000 for their program.
Is that what it was?
One of the things that was really cool is you had Tom Ryan and Sean Bormet and Kevin Dresser were among the donors who chipped in to help Campbell. Yeah, that's really cool for a Division I head coaches of another program to chip in for a program that they could be theoretically competing against at some point.
I love hearing that. That's good for the sport. I wish we would have, and maybe you knew about it, but as we were recording, I think you learned about it afterward.
Yeah.
And so I think we wish that would have come out, or we would have known about that going into the show, because it was such a cool concept that, hey, wrestling does support wrestling. And that's pretty unique in any sport to be able to have that kind of support. Just a couple other things before we get to our guests. One of the things is we're talking about how we've grown into a different sport, and we've talked about good coaching and how the athletes are as prepared as they've ever been. I think there's a new narrative that's come with that, and it was struck me when we had Tom Brands on the program, and he was talking about how it's entertainment-driven and that we're here as an entertainment sport. And when I grew up, it was all about wins and losses. That was the marquee. And now it seems like it's more about what kind of product can you put on the mat that's entertaining. We've heard that a lot. We've heard Spencer Lee talk about this. I think he said, this is an entertainment sport. This is what we do. It's about entertainment. I think that's a new narrative within the last 5 to 10 years that we didn't hear throughout the history of our sport. I always saw it as this combat sport. It's primitive and the best man wins. Now we're talking about, we're going to go out there and we want to entertain. And I think that's something new. And it seems like coaches like Tom Brands are even picking up on that. And I guess it surprised me as I've thought back to it. I guess it surprises me that you would hear that from Tom, but he had an entertaining style. It was a bruising style and we were entertained by him. I don't know that while he was competing, he thought about entertaining the fans, but he certainly did as a byproduct of his style.
Remember Tom and his introductory press conference at Iowa talking about that, though. 13 years ago.
He talked about entertainment? Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Yep. He talked about wanting to put an entertaining product on the mat and how it wasn't just enough to win. You want to win in grand fashion and put on a show. So I think it's more prevalent that people are talking about it, though. I think to your point, I don't think a lot of people were talking about it a decade ago. And now it seems like now athletes are talking about it. Coaches across the country are talking about it. Put an entertaining product out on the mat. People are going to want to show up and watch it. You don't, it's going to be hard to capture the casual fan, capture the attention of the casual fan. I mean, we read off some of those scores that were taking place a decade ago. Remember that, some of the dual meet scores that we read off in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah.
And what the sport was like 10 years ago. It's interesting. I think the product is come a long way, even in the last 5 years, from an entertainment standpoint. I think some rule changes have contributed to that. I think just a higher level of wrestling has contributed to that. I think being cognizant and people wanting to go out and put it on the line and put points on the board has contributed to that. I hope that this is just a sign of things to come. I hope that we're trending in that direction or continuing to trend in that direction, because crowds are headed upward. Attendance figures are headed upward, trending upward across the country. And let's give them something to keep coming back for. I remember there was one year, Iowa had a dual meet where they had a lot of people in the stands and just wasn't a super entertaining duel. And I remember Gable talking about how felt like as a sport, we missed an opportunity that we might not get those fans back. You know, some of them might not come back just because they weren't entertained. So you can go out and put a lot of points on the board and still lose. And I think people will still get behind that. They'll still feel like they got entertained. And, you know, see somebody go out there and stand around for 7 minutes and you win. But yeah, we won, but it wasn't that fun to watch.
Well, yeah. I mean, Dylan Ness never won a national championship, but we remember him.
Yeah.
He put a great, entertaining product on the mat, and I think there's a lot to be said about that. I'll remember that guy more than the guy that stood around and won an NCAA championship. I know that doesn't get a banner, and it doesn't get your name as an NCAA champion, but from what you remember, the way you leave feeling the arena, Dylan Ness has as high a marks as you're going to get, because he definitely did put on a show.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Final thing.
He was dangerous.
He was. Yeah, there you go. Another guy that I'm glad we brought him up. He defines dangerous too. Hey, as we talk about this and we think about some of the lineup challenges, one of the narratives that continues to get brought up, and it's just a common saying, everyone says it. I don't think they understand why they say it, but it's a good problem to have. And as we break that down, And I understand what they're saying, isn't it just a problem instead of a good problem? Can't we just take that off and just say, hey, it's a challenge. It's something you have to deal with. It's not necessarily a good problem to have, but it's what you have at that point. I understand you're saying, hey, you have two good guys at a weight class. That's a good problem to have. I just think it's a problem and it's a challenge instead of trying to normalize it by saying it's a good problem. Why not just accept it for what it is, that it's a challenge that a coach has to face?
Or is it just a luxury?
That would be even better. Yeah, I think, okay, that's even better. Instead of saying it's a good problem, trying to double up on words there, I think luxury is better. I think it is a luxury to have two good guys in the program.
Now, it's a luxury to have Oklahoma State's depth.
Sure.
At certain weights. It's a luxury to, like Cale Sanderson's got two good heavyweights. It's a luxury to have two good 49-pounders like he has. Those are luxuries, I think. I don't think they're problems.
Yeah, but you hear
that. Semantics, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you hear it's a good problem to have. How many times have you heard that being said about when there's two good guys, oh, they have to fit, but that's a good problem to have.
Yeah, the coach always says it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, and so immediately you're going to hear that. And just one more gripe.
What's a good problem that you have right now, Kyle?
How we're going to get the equal amount of guests that are good going forward for the next five years.
That's a good problem to have.
It is a good problem to have.
And it's a luxury.
It is. I love figuring this out, and I love this show. My final gripe is – when you'll hear the announcer say, we're going to take a quick 10-minute break. You don't need the quick on there. You can just say,
we're going to take a 10-minute break.
Yeah. Just take off the quick or short.
Concise.
Yeah. Just the 10 minutes is the time. You could say, we're going to take a quick 2-hour break.
Or you could say, it's going to be a slow 10-minute break.
You could say that too. Or just a moderately slow or a moderately fast. Just say, it's going to be a 10-minute break. That's all you have to say, because the 10 minutes is the time. You're setting the standard. You don't need to say it's a quick 10-minute break. Am I right? As someone that
you're dead on
values grammar, you should just know.
You're spot on.
It's a 10-minute break. We have no time right now. We have to get into our guest. Let's go out to Blacksburg, Virginia. Our guest today, 2-time All-American for Edinburgh. Now he's the head wrestling coach at Virginia Tech after a unique path. Went through a lot of different coaching jobs. Was it Binghamton? Was it Michigan? Now he's the head man at Virginia Tech. Tony Roby is our guest. How are you, Tony?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
We're doing good, man. And when I think of you, for some reason, I just put you in the same vein as Sean Bormet. I just see a guy that on the surface is really tough. How true is that?
I like to think it's true. I physically, I think I look a lot like Sean Bormet. At least I get told that a lot.
Yeah.
Used to compete against Sean a little bit too. So I'll take that as a compliment, but I think, you know, I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania, which really blue collar upbringing and went to public school there in Erie and, you know, grew up lower middle class. So, you know, I think that is part of my background and part of my roots. And, you know, if that makes people think of me as tough, I guess I'll take it.
So with the Sean Bormet question, do people mix you guys up at tournaments?
Yeah, it used to happen a lot more, but yeah, definitely. And especially when I was at Michigan, because when I went, I was in Michigan for 4 years, I think 2001, 2003, and 2004, and I'd replaced Sean on staff at that particular time. So we kind of both had that Michigan connection, in fact, when he was at overtime and I was at Michigan, kids would come up to me at Fargo and, you know, they would think I was Sean, kids at Ruffin for overtime. So it was pretty funny. And me and Sean laughed about it a lot.
So going back to your upbringing, when you are in Erie, Pennsylvania, it is a blue collar town. Is that the expectation that you get in a combat sport like wrestling?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, and I think it's part of the reason, you know, places like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Ohio, Iowa are such good wrestling states, is you just have a blue collar mentality and people from that walks of life. And I think that lends itself to a lot of the things that it takes to be great in the sport of wrestling, as far as toughness and work ethic and those kind of things.
Was there rivalry being in Erie, Pennsylvania with other parts of PA? Was that something you were conscious of?
You know, not a lot for me at that particular time. I didn't really wrestle a lot in high school. I wrestled for about 3 months, played football, and didn't put my wrestling shoes on for the majority of the off season. So, I don't even know that I was aware of any rivalries. I mean, to me, you know, if you wrestled somebody from Southwest PA, from the WPIL, from Pittsburgh area, they were usually, I guess, a little more well-rounded as wrestlers, a little more experienced, competed a little bit more. But for me, you know, wrestling was almost a hobby for me until I got to college.
So take us through that. That's interesting. Was that something was it 3 months a year you trained? How did the training cycle go for you if you were in other sports?
Yeah, I mean, I that's really it. I mean, I started wrestling in first grade, so I wrestled my entire life. But it wasn't something that I did in the off season. I don't think that I wrestled. I could count on one hand how many freestyle tournaments I wrestled in before I got to college. So for me, and we never traveled very far. I mean, I don't think I ever, maybe once or twice, left the state of Pennsylvania, and that was just maybe going over the border into Ohio to compete growing up. So it was a different time, you know, a little bit. Kids didn't quite do as much traveling as they do now, but I was probably the exception in terms of, you know, my level of experience and commitment and just exposure, I guess is the best word, to year-round wrestling and to high-level technique and high-level coaching and that kind of thing. I played football all through high school and, you know, was probably more focused on that than I was on wrestling until I got to college.
If it was a hobby, how did you decide on wrestling in college?
I didn't have much of a choice. You know, I was 5 foot nine or 10 or whatever I was, and, you know, wasn't the fastest guy in the world, so I didn't have a lot of opportunities. I could have probably played, you know, Division III for sure in football and maybe Division II, I don't know. But I didn't have a lot of options, and I wasn't heavily recruited. I placed third twice in the state of Pennsylvania, which, you know, is obviously PA is a good wrestling state, but I wasn't heavily recruited. I went on three official visits, one to Edinburgh, one to Lock Haven, and then Indiana University brought me out. And Edinburgh was the only school that offered me any kind of scholarship, and it wasn't a lot, and it was 20 minutes from home, and my brother went to school there, and, you know, a lot of my friends went to school there because it was so close. So it was just an opportunity that presented itself, and it was, you know, I didn't have a lot of other choices, so it was an easy decision.
Do you feel like you were able to grow at Edinburgh? You got on the stand a couple times, reached the finals in 1997, which is a huge accomplishment. How did you develop into that high caliber wrestler?
I think just I was exposed to some great people and great coaches, and really just learned how to work. I didn't necessarily know what kind of work it took to be good at the national level as a college wrestler. So once I got exposed to that and started to have some, you know, once I started doing that kind of work and I had people that started to believe in me, Lou Roselli and Tim Flynn were a huge part of my development as an athlete and as a person. And, you know, once I started to see what it could do for me and the results that I could get, once I started committing myself to this, I was a pretty good athlete. So, you know, it built my confidence, and it was just kind of a snowball effect from there. And at some point, I think probably I wrestled as a true freshman and kind of got thrown to the wolves, wasn't ready probably for Division I wrestling. But about halfway through my freshman year, I realized that I could compete at this level, and, you know, probably, you know, into my second year at Edinburgh, I figured out that, you know, I could have a pretty good future and could compete with anybody in the country.
Tony, just looking at your bio here, it says you were you won the school's Academic Achievement Award before graduating with a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. Where did you think your life was going before coaching became your livelihood, before you got you realized that wrestling was become your livelihood, and how did you get to this point?
That's a great question. You know, probably my dad owned a bar, like right in Erie, and probably was going to move back to Erie and figure something out. I don't know if I would have worked there, if I would have gotten to my field of choice, but you know, I can't sit here and say that I had a concrete plan or I knew exactly what I was going to do if the wrestling gig didn't pan out for me. But I will say this much. At some point, early on in my college career, I kind of started to figure out that wrestling, you know, that I could have a future in wrestling. And I didn't know that it would ever lead me to where I am today or, you know, the places that I've been. But it certainly was a life-changing experience for me and the opportunities that it provided for me, you know, to do some different things that I otherwise probably wouldn't have been able to do.
You wrestled Joe Williams in the 1997 NCAA championship finals. He is a three-time NCAA champion. What's it like wrestling Joe Williams?
Oh, it was bad timing. I mean, he was Joe Williams. He presented a lot of problems for me. You know, and Joe probably struggled more with guys, and not that Joe struggled. I mean, he was obviously an all-time great, but you know, from a strategy standpoint, if I had to do it over again, I probably, you know, Joe, he did really well against guys that came after him, and that was kind of my style. I shot a lot, and I tried to score a lot of points, and that played into what Joe was good at. He struggled a little bit more with guys that kind of stood around and didn't do as much and kept it close and had that kind of mentality, and that wasn't really my mentality. I tried to go out there and you know, tried to score takedowns on him and tried to get to his legs and wasn't very successful at it. So the one thing that I, you know, vividly remember about Russ and Joe is he was just so incredibly strong. It was unbelievable. Strongest guy that I've ever wrestled in my life. I mean, you could you know, it was very difficult to get to him. And when you did get to him, you know, just tough to pick his leg up or tough to really get to his body and finish takedowns on. So, I lost to him, I think, three times in college. I lost him in the Midlands Finals twice and lost him in the NCAA Finals as well.
Let's get your take on this. This is a hot topic. Last episode of our show, we have a segment called Casper's Corner. And I believe the question that he posed was, would you rather get to the NCAA Finals, finish second, knowing you got every ounce out of your ability possible? Or would you rather get first place and maybe not reach the full potential that you had? What would your answer be to that?
God, that's a tough question. Of course, I'd rather be an NCAA champion. But I don't know. I mean, for me personally, all I can do is draw upon my experience. And I do feel like that, you know, I don't have a lot of regrets for my college wrestling career based on what I put into it and what I accomplished and where I was when I started and where I got to when I finished and how things played out for me. I mean, I feel like I invested everything that I could invest into getting there. So I felt good about it regardless of whether, you know, I won it or not and, you know, beat a lot of guys that won the Nationals along the way, but it just wasn't in the cards. So to me, I don't know. It's a tough question to answer. You just kind of play the hand that you're dealt, and that was the hand that I was dealt, and I'm fine with it.
You talk about beating an NCAA champion. You beat Ernest Benyon, who was an NCAA champion in 1995, and of course we're talking about 1997, and then he was in the finals the year before. Do you lose a little bit of your momentum going into the finals, knowing that you won a huge match in the semis, and then you got to get up again for Joe Williams in the finals?
Yeah, I don't think I lost a lot of momentum. It was definitely a difficult road. There's no question. I actually lost to Ernest in 1995 in overtime in the semifinals of the Nationals, and that was the year that he went on and won it. And then I registered the following year, and then I beat him in overtime in 97 in the semifinals. But it was certainly, that was a big win emotionally for me, you know, just because I had lost to him in the same spot 2 years prior to that. So, you know, perhaps, but at the end of the day, I mean, I wrestled Joe several, you know, three times in college and a couple times in freestyle, and he had my number, so I don't think it had a whole lot to do with the momentum.
On the coaching front, one thing, I didn't realize this, I don't know why it's a hole in my memory, but you were the head wrestling coach at Binghamton, and then you went back to being an assistant, and now you are a head coach. Taking that route where you're head coach, assistant, now head coach again, you have a unique experience. What's it like going from head coach back to being an assistant coach?
Well, I was the head coach, so I don't know if you remember. So Binghamton had dropped the program, and then they hired me to restart it. And I think it was January of 2005, if I'm remembering correctly. So I was only there for about 14 months. And then when I came to Virginia Tech, Kevin Dresser had, you know, he was a very successful high school coach at the time, but he was a high school coach. So when I came to Virginia Tech, you know, me and Kevin shared a lot of the responsibilities, and so it wasn't a whole lot different. Obviously, I wasn't in charge, but I think it was very effective, just, you know, helping Kevin, you know, get acclimated to some of the differences between high school and college, and obviously it was an easy transition for him. But you know, for me, the move from Binghamton to Virginia Tech, a lot of it was just I liked being at a major university. I like being at a place that has significant resources. When I came down here to look at the campus and the school, and you know, from a quality of life standpoint, it was a good move for me and my family, and just felt right. And you know, obviously, things worked out good for me. It was, in retrospect, a good move. I was the associate head coach here for I think 12 years before I got the head coaching gig. But I have no regrets about it. It was a good decision, and I never really regretted it, even all those years as the associate head coach here.
Having the opportunity to sit in a head coach's chair there for that period of time at Binghamton before you go back to being an assistant, how much does that help you in preparing for this role that you got now?
It definitely helped. I think, you know, when you're the head coach, you got to make all the decisions. So it helped in that aspect. But it was a completely different, you know, situation. We were starting a program from scratch. I got hired in January, and we had to field a team for the following year. There wasn't one wrestler on campus. So I had to recruit, basically. I mean, you had all true freshmen, number one, or transfers. And you had, you know, very limited time to recruit the kids at that particular point in the season. So, you know, then moving to what I walked into here at Virginia Tech, you know, we had finished fourth and sixth at the NCAAs 2 years prior to that. So this thing was up and running. It was a completely different animal than the situation at Virginia Tech. But I do think there's definitely some things that I learned that were helpful for me just in coaching in general, maybe not even as the head coach, but just that whole experience, I think, was very beneficial for me and helped me down the path that I came.
What was the most beneficial thing you learned from Kevin Dresser?
Kevin, I think, as much as anything, he's unique. I think he looks at things differently than a lot of people. And I think probably if I had to narrow down to one thing, it was just kind of thinking outside of the box. You know, he's proven that he's really good at doing things maybe a little bit differently, and it's not always the way that things are traditionally done in our sport. But that would be one of the things, you know, that comes to mind.
Going back to the Binghamton, I think most people know that Billy Baldwin wrestled at Binghamton. Was that a relationship you had while you were there?
Yeah, absolutely. Billy was, he wasn't afraid to get in the weeds on things. I mean, that guy would, I remember he came up multiple times, and he would go, you know, go around town and stop at places and solicit money for the program and work the phones. And as much as he supported the program, you know, from a financial standpoint, it was just his work ethic and, the visibility that he had and his passion for it that was really the most impressive thing. I mean, if he told you he was going to do something, he was going to do it. So he was very, very involved, developed a great friendship with Billy, and, you know, still maintain that today and love seeing him every year at the NCAA championship. So Billy was the real deal. There's no question about it. He was, he's a big part of the success that program has had over the years.
Going back to Kevin Dresser, what a strange time when Iowa State lures him away. You have that gap where he's back at Iowa State, isn't coaching the team, but watching from the sideline, and now you're the interim coach. Where were you in all of this, seeing it transpire? Can you take us through your thoughts and just the maybe confusion of what was going to happen with the program?
To be quite honest with you, you know, it was at such a critical time in the season that I really tried to just focus my attention on making sure our guys were prepared and trying to just kind of galvanize things and make sure that, you know, that there was no negative effect on the individuals on our team. You know, we had guys that had invested a lot into their wrestling career and had incredibly high goals. And, you know, we wanted to finish that year out strong and make sure that, as much as anything, that the guys on our team had the opportunity to accomplish the things that they deserved to have that opportunity to do. So, that's kind of where my focus was at. And obviously in the back of my head, you know, how things were going to transpire, in the future was there for sure. But at the same time, you know, my focus was really on just trying to win an ACC title and trying to get a bunch of guys on the stand at the NCAA tournament and finish as high as we possibly could as a team.
Isn't it kind of crazy, though, how things have transpired once Tom Brands went there, how relevant Virginia Tech has been since that point? It's a program we're talking about. Now you're at the helm of that. What has your thoughts been as you've seen all of this transpire since Tom Brands took over?
Well, I'm not surprised, and that's part of the reason that I left a head coaching job at Binghamton to come to Virginia Tech as the associate head coach. Is if you've ever been on this campus or, you know, been to Blacksburg, Virginia, it's an awesome place. So it's an easy place to recruit to. People want to be here. So there was the potential was always there. So I think it was just a matter of getting the right people in place. And I think once Virginia Tech made a commitment to the sport of wrestling, you know, and hired, got the right people in place. It was just a matter of time, really, because there's just so much to offer down here, you know, to potential student athletes. And, you know, it's an easy sell.
Makai Lewis is a stud, man. That guy won a junior world championship and is just a guy that has an elite level of wrestling. What has he done for your program that's helped elevate it and made coaching a little bit easier for you?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you hit it right on. Makai to me is the, you know, he's the whole package. From what you want in a student athlete. Athletically, he's elite. There's no question about that. That's easy to see. But, you know, I think what separates Makai from a lot of people is his commitment and his work ethic and his drive and pride. I mean, the guy, he just wants to win really bad when he steps on the mat, and he's willing to prepare. And I think, he, you know, kind of burst on the scene this year when he won that junior world title. But we were fortunate, you know, we got to see Makai when he was young and kind of see what he was all about and had a connection at his high school. So I wasn't surprised that Makai's developed the way that he has, especially once you get to know him personally and once you see what he's all about and see what his character is all about and his work ethic's all about. But I think Makai's effect on our program is still to be determined. I mean, he's still a freshman. You know, that's the great thing about coaching him is he hasn't even wrestled at the NCAA tournament one time yet. So that's pretty exciting when you think about it as a coach that you get to sit in that guy's corner, you know, four times at the NCAA tournament. I think he's going to do some incredible things and help elevate Virginia Tech wrestling to another level.
Tony, when you look back on what he accomplished last year, he was what, fourth or fifth out in Vegas, I think?
Yeah, he was fifth.
Yep. And then he goes 5 months later and wins a junior world title. Could you see the leaps and bounds on a daily basis in terms of development?
Yeah, I felt like he could have won the Open. I think he underachieved a little bit at the U.S. Open for whatever reason, didn't have a great tournament. And so, you know, that was basically his first freestyle tournament. I think he wrestled and won, like, I don't know, county freestyle tournament or something when he was in high school, but it was literally the first time that he competed in freestyle on the national level. So, and as you know, freestyle is, you know, there's some subtle differences that you have to kind of experience to really get your arms around as an athlete. And I think it was a great experience. And you know, probably placing fifth there was maybe the best thing that happened to Makai, because like I said earlier, I mean, he's got tremendous amount of pride, and I think it motivated him, and he got a look in his eye, and the way he approached his training for the trials and then for the world championships was fun to watch and see and be a part of. I mean, the guy, he definitely was all in, and you could see that he was on a mission to do something special.
Transfers are becoming more prevalent in college athletics, particularly in wrestling. You guys have three guys that came in this year, in Tom Slave and Billy Miller and Corbin Myers. How did those opportunities present themselves? How did all three of those guys land at Virginia Tech, and how have they acclimated to your program?
Yeah, we actually have four transfers in our lineup, too. Ryan Blease was at Oklahoma State for 2 years prior to coming to Virginia Tech. So, yeah, it's definitely the landscape of college wrestling has changed in that sense, where you are seeing a lot more guys transfer. And I think it's only going to continue to increase with this transfer portal that the NCAA has. You're seeing a lot more of them in other sports. But as far as those individuals are concerned, Tom Slay, they had contacted us. Tom had graduated from Bucknell, and from an academic standpoint, what he wanted to do and what he wanted to study, I don't think was an option for him at Bucknell. So he made a decision that he was going to leave Bucknell and started looking at some other places. And I'm pretty good friends with Coach, with Dan Wernsberger, another guy that I competed against in college. So, you know, Dan was pretty helpful in directing him. Once he knew that Tom was going to leave Bucknell, Dan had coached at Virginia Tech for a couple of years too, earlier in his coaching career, and I had a good relationship with him. So, you know, that didn't hurt us. And I think, like I said earlier, you know, once we got Tom down here and we were able to figure out major wise what was going to work for him, and we got him into a 1-year program where he's getting a master's degree in business analytics, it just made a lot of sense, you know, for Tom with Ty Walls here as a training partner to have another big guy and, you know, Zach Savatsky, and just from a workout partner standpoint, I think it was a no-brainer for Tom. As far as Billy and Corbin were concerned, my connections, I think, at Edinburgh helped out a lot there when Tim Flynn left to go to West Virginia, and there was a lot of changes that were taking place with the program at Edinburgh. Those guys were starting to look for places to go, and I think they had a comfort level. Not that I knew them that well. I did know Billy fairly well. Billy's high school coach comes to our camp every summer. His name's Dave Rohn. He was an NCAA All-American at Edinburgh back in the day. Is a pretty good friend of mine, so I had a relationship with Billy that I think probably helped a little bit. And I think my ties to Edinburgh and my relationship with Tim Flynn and the fact that me and Tim are really good friends helped their comfort level a lot with making the decision to come to Virginia Tech. And the transition was great. I mean, those guys fit in very well. They're hardworking guys, and it was pretty much seamless.
You've had some great success. You have a relevant program. You guys have gotten a team trophy. You got that a couple years ago. Still striving for that individual NCAA champion. When you get that, how much will that mean for the Hokies and your program?
Yeah, it's important for us. It's definitely something that is high on our list of goals as a program to accomplish. And we've had some really good guys that have gotten really close. I think it's definitely one of the next steps for us that we, you know, not only have to get our first one, but we, you know, we want to be putting guys in the finals and getting NCAA champions on an annual basis. So that's truly what our goal is. And when you have those kind of guys that can win titles and put themselves in a position to win titles, you're going to finish really high as a team. So it's definitely something that we don't necessarily talk about it all the time, but it's important. It's the next step for us, and I'm excited. I think we got, you know, several guys in our room that can make that happen, and we got several recruits coming in that I think are at that level as well. So it's our job to coach them up.
You, as we mentioned, were one spot below winning a championship. Just from your vantage point, how difficult is it to win five matches at the national tournament and get it done?
You just have to take it one match at a time. You know, I think you can't make more out of it than it is. Obviously, it's not an easy thing to do. But at the same time, you know, there's going to be one champ at every weight. So, you know, why not you? I think if you have that kind of attitude, you take it one match at a time and good things are going to happen. You know, like I said, we've had guys that have been close, but there's definitely some timing involved, getting in a situation where, hopefully you don't have Kyle Bake at your weight class or Kale Sanderson, because that makes it a little more challenging too. But, it's just about going in there and focusing on yourself and believing that you can get it done and just having that kind of mindset and approaching it like you would any other match.
Do you feel like our qualification system to get to the national tournament is fair right now?
I do. I think, you know, getting back to Virginia Tech, getting from where it was to where it is now, the qualification system changing had a lot to do with that. When I first got to Virginia Tech, they did it on historical data. So I think it was like I'm not exactly sure what the formula was, but it was for the prior 4 years data. So they were using data that really wasn't relevant to your team at that particular year. So it was tough to increase qualifiers. So the ACC had 14 qualifiers. So we took the champ at each weight, and then we had to vote. The coaches voted on 4 wild cards. So once they changed that system, it really just opened the doors from a recruiting standpoint to get kids, because a lot of kids were hesitant to come when you know, they weren't sure if they were going to be able to have a fair path to the NCAA. So, yeah, I love the qualifying system the way it is currently.
Tony, the strength of the ACC now and the development of that conference, how have you seen that filter down to wrestling as a whole in that region of the country?
I think the ACC is far and away the best it's ever been in the sport of wrestling, and I think there's far more parity even this year than there has been in the past, and I think we've seen that this past weekend, you know, with some upsets in the ACC. But again, you know, getting back to the institutions, once I think they committed the resources and hired really good people, you know, and made the decision that they were going to make a commitment to the sport of wrestling, were geographically in pretty good places to recruit, especially us. We're you know, within 5 or 6 hours of most places in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New Jersey. So, you know, you have that kind of natural recruiting ground. And all of the institutions are great academically. The campuses are fantastic. They're in a great part of the country. So there's a lot of things to sell. I think it was just a matter of the schools making the commitment to the sport of wrestling from a resource standpoint, getting the right people in place. And then, you know, it was just a matter of time after that.
Do you like dual meets? That's a debate we have a lot. Where do you stand on making some sort of a dual meet championship?
I like it. I like it a lot, actually. I think, you know, I think our fans like it. You know, I mean, when it matters and they're given regular season titles or whatever it may be, they're a lot of fun and they're competitive, and I think things get heated, and it's, to me, it's an important part of our sport that we need to continue to develop and grow and place importance upon. So yeah, I'm a big fan of the dual meets.
What does a casual fan want? We can't use Andy Hamilton here as an example because he goes to bed thinking about it. He wakes up thinking about it. It's all he thinks about all day long. What does the casual fan want?
The casual fan, I think they want to be a part of it. I think, you know, the one thing that we've done a pretty good job of at Virginia Tech is reaching out to our fan base, cultivating that relationship, making them feel like they're a part of the program, allowing them to feel like they, you know, get to know our wrestlers and our athletes and kind of open your arms up and welcome them in. And it's, you know, and that's, you know, one of the things Coach Dresser was great at is developing that fan base. So, you know, I think people want to be a part of something, especially when you're winning. So I think it's your job as a coach and as a staff and as a program to reach out and to market it. And I think if you do that and you have a great product to sell, people are going to come watch it.
Any chance we'll see Iowa State on the Virginia Tech wrestling schedule?
Maybe. Who knows? Yeah, that's something that me and Kevin have not spoke about, but, you know, that's something that we might see in the future.
One thing that Andy and I are very adamant in changing is just the way that dual meets are scored. Right now, we think it's pretty out of touch. You get 3 points for a decision all the way up to a 6 points for a pin. We just want to see cumulative scoring. In our world, a fall would be worth 22 points because the max you can get for a Tech fall is 21. What would you think about doing something like that where it's cumulative scoring?
I don't love it. You guys would have to sell me on that.
We will. We can do that.
You guys would have to sell me. I don't know. I mean, I think that's pretty drastic. I'm not saying that you couldn't tweak it a little bit, but I don't know. You know, that's to me, I kind of like the way the scoring is done now. I think it allows for some more upsets. Matchups matter. And, you know, in injuries don't quite kill you as much with the current format, you know. So if you have to throw a backup in there and they lose by 21 points, that's tough to overcome. But one thing that I do think could change is the tournament scoring. And I think on the consolation with bonus points, especially on the consolation side of the bracket, to me it doesn't make a lot of sense that a pin in the first round of the consolations at the NCAAs is this, you put the same value of that as you do as a pin in the NCAA finals. So I'll pose that to you guys. What do you guys think of that?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I like anything that can kind of get us progressing in that way. I think for sure one thing I don't like is that you get the same amount of points on the back half when you get to the consolation. So a fall is worth, like you say, double.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm agreeing with you on that point. Like, hey, I'm for sure on board with how that works. I think it's ridiculous that you have an advancement go in half and then all of the bonus stays the same. So I think it should just be cut in half. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. But to our point though, what we would counter to you is a 1-0 win in the dual meet world is worth every bit as much as a 14-7 win. So you're rewarding a guy saying that the margin of 1 point, if you get 1 point more, you go up to 8, is worth more than a 7-point win. I just think in any other sport, that reality doesn't exist. If you did that in football, you'd say you're crazy if you win by so much in a quarter and you get so many points in a quarter. I'm saying it's crazy for wrestling. Let's just make points matter, and let's not make those 3-2 matches worth as much as a 14-7. That's our argument.
Yeah, I could be sold on that, or maybe, some type of increase in the difference between a regular decision and a major decision and a major decision and attack and, and an attack and a pin. So that kind of, makes some sense.
Or to your example, when you talked about Dake saying, hey, I don't want to meet Dake in the finals, in a dual meet scenario, Dake and Taylor, if they wrestle, someone's coming out with points, the other guy isn't. Shouldn't there be some sort of an incentive that both guys are going to be able to benefit your team and not a feast or famine?
Yeah, I guess I can see it like that. I don't know, man. I'm not sold on it.
Okay, we'll sell you on it in Pittsburgh. We'll get you on our pre-tournament show, Tony, and we'll sell you on it there.
All right.
We like these dialogues. That's why we want to have it. We're not trying to solve all the world's problems here, but we're just trying to look at a way to make the sport.
Let's just get rid of the hands of the face, and I'll be happy.
Yeah, so take us through that. We've seen some scenarios here this season. It's got to be frustrating as a coach.
Very frustrating. We lost a match in our last dual meet, in the closing seconds, and with a hands of the face call that I didn't, certainly didn't think was warranted. Mekhi Lewis lost a match earlier this year. We gave up two hands of the face. So, I don't love it. Let's put it that way. I mean, I guess I can see the intent a little bit when guys are out there and they're kind of jabbing you in the face to keep distance. But, I just think it went too far, and we're seeing it far too often. And it's deciding the outcome of dual meets and matches. And, it could decide the outcome of who wins an NCAA title in Pittsburgh this year, just by putting your hands and, inadvertently putting your hands on somebody's face. I mean, it's wrestling. It's part of wrestling. It's something these kids have been doing their entire lives. So to ask them to go out there and instinctively not do it in the course of a match is tough for them to do. So I don't love it. I think most college coaches feel the same way.
We'll end with this. What are your thoughts on soda? Do you like it? What do you drink if you do? What do you think about the soda debate?
On soda?
Yeah.
Way out of left field, but we ask this week after week.
That's our questions.
I'm not a big soda guy. I'll be honest with you. I get two of my children are type 1 diabetics. We don't drink a lot of soda at the Roby house.
Really?
So not a big soda guy.
Coffee?
Coffee, yeah. I definitely like coffee.
Okay. How about, do you get a lot of sleep at night?
I'm not a great sleeper. I try to have a difficult time sleeping.
Yeah. A lot of things going through your head about your team and what you're going to prepare
for. Yeah, whatever it may be, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. Hey, we appreciate this. We had a lot of fun with you. We will see you in your home state of Pennsylvania. Hopefully you got enough tickets allocated for your fans. I doubt it, but hopefully they can come and support you.
I appreciate the time, guys. Thanks for having me on.
All right. That was Coach Tony Roby. He has a solid program at Virginia Tech and really enjoyed what he had to say. And I think that there's so many good things that can happen for that program, Andy, that it's a program that is relevant now. And I think it's going to continue to be relevant just because of who's at the helm.
Yeah, they got some momentum, right? I mean, some stuff going on there that wasn't happening 11, 12, 13 years ago. Beyond, I mean, they generated a great deal of excitement. There's tradition. I think when Tom Brands got there, they had maybe had one All-American in school history, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's right, because when they had two, it was, I think it doubled it, yeah.
Yeah, then they had Hoffman and Borgia, and then, they go through the coaching change, and Kevin Dresser, they were able to make some serious facilities upgrades, I think, and then making inroads in recruiting. They put themselves on the map, and suddenly a program that you never thought about, at least I outside of, what was it, Scott Justice maybe at 184 pounds, and Sean Gray at 141. Outside of those two guys, I can't really remember a whole lot of Virginia Tech guys from about 2000 to about 2005, 2006, right in there. And now all of a sudden you're talking about some guys that have gone on and done some pretty remarkable things in that program. Ty Walsh was incredibly fun to watch at heavyweight, putting up a lot of points and goes over and wins a U23 medal a year ago. And Devin Carter making the finals after a pretty serious, was it hamstring injury that hampered him?
I forgot he was injured.
And we're just seeing a bunch of guys, great stories now. Makai Lewis, like we talked about with Tony Robey, goes from fifth at out in Vegas up to winning a junior world title 5 months later.
And that's one of your favorite stories. I think you came back and you were buzzing about Makai Lewis and his story. And that was such a neat moment for us.
I came away from watching him up in Rochester at the trials thinking, you know what? I think this guy might be able to medal. And then, boy, he got on a roll over there. Slovakia looked great. And what a story that was.
Makai Lewis, someone we're going to watch out for, part of that youth wrestling movement. Had a great time talking with Tony Robey. As always, if you have questions, want to get in touch with us, Twitter, email, Facebook, however you want to get us a question, we will put it into our mailbag. As always, for Andrew Hamilton, I am Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.